Welcome to the Martin Bailey Photography Podcast. It's April 15, 2014, and this is episode 417. Today, I welcome back my friend and regular guest, David Duchemin, for a conversation about his latest Craft and Vision ebook, The Visual Imagination: Ideas and Techniques for Creative Photographic Expression. This episode is brought to you by Lynda.com. Learn lighting, portraiture, Photoshop skills, and more from expert-taught video courses. To start your 7-day free trial, visit lynda.com/MBP. Now let's jump into my conversation with David Duchemin. So welcome back to the show, David.
Thank you, Martin Bailey.
Yeah, it's always wonderful to you've become like you're a regular guest, so it's not always nice to have you on here.
Yeah, I look forward to our conversations together.
So congratulations on the Visual Imagination. You've just released, literally as we record, it's just going out the door. So you've just released your latest ebook that we're going to have a good chinwag about today.
Thank you. Yeah, it's exciting. You know, every time you release something that you've put your heart and soul into, there's always a little bit of nervousness. But I'm particularly gratified by this one.
Yeah, and rightly so. I read my preview copy yesterday, and I'm blown away. It's a wonderful addition to your library or your collection. What would you call it? Not a collection.
Thank you. I don't know. I guess if I were using big words, it would be a bibliography. Perhaps
that works.
My oeuvre. I don't know. just around these here parts, it's just the crap I keep writing. So.
Brilliant. Okay, so you've obviously taken a leg of your photography off in a wonderful direction with some of the images that you've included in the book, we'll talk through this a little bit. But I think one of the things that struck me the moment I started reading, it really put on a light bulb, was that you'd in your opening section you mentioned that we've got to let go of the need to understand art, especially modern and abstract art. You know, people tend to think that you've got to understand art, and you open with a great section about letting go of that need. Can you talk to us a little bit about that?
Yeah, I can. I could probably talk to you for hours about it, because it's kind of where my artistic energy is being spent right now, or the place from which it's being spent is this. You know, this realization that you don't have to understand everything. For a long time, I've been talking about photographic language, and I still strongly believe that. But there is a sense in which we can't. Photography has been, for so long, it's been really literal. Mm. You know, we've been using it to document things, and everything is sharp and technically adheres to certain principles. And yet, you can, just like with language, you can, instead of writing a really well-written, well-argued piece of non-fiction that maybe would be the parallel with a literal piece of documentary photography. Mm. You can also write poetry that is, maybe you don't understand it. Maybe you read something like Gerard Manley Hopkins, who was like a, you know, 17th century Jesuit priest, and his language, you know, there's several generations, several centuries between us. Mm. And yet you can just read it, and even if you don't fully understand what he's saying, you can have an experience. Mm. And the same thing, I think, when you look at a piece of art on a wall, very often I think we prevent ourselves from having an experience of it, because the first thing we think is, I don't understand it. You know, mm-hmm. you look at Jackson Pollock and you think, wow, my 4-year-old could do this. well, this wasn't made by a 4-year-old. It was made by a conscious artist who's trying to say something, but was he trying to be understood? I'm not sure. And that's where I had this light bulb moment, was reading the introduction to a book about Kandinsky. Mm-hmm. And the guy writing the introduction said Kandinsky was painting music, and this light bulb went off in my head. Yeah. And connected some dots for me, because I've been looking at the Impressionists and I've been studying people like Van Gogh, and there are times when, you know, when I get out of my comfort zone and beyond that into sort of more modern art and abstracts, I kind of scratch my head and go, I don't understand it. But if I'm free from the need to understand, just like with music, I don't listen to Wagner's Ride of the Valkyries and try to understand it, or anything, frankly, that Chopin, Mozart, or I don't know what they were trying to say. Mm. But with the language of music, they were creating something that I could experience separate from a rational understanding. Now, perhaps a rational understanding would make that experience even deeper, but I don't think it's necessary. Mm. And so it kind of, you know, the long answer to your question, but it's this sense of creating an experience in our photography, not just kind of passing a note that has content to be understood, but passing a poem or, you know, just something to be felt.
Mm. Yeah.
And I think that's, I mean, that's where it all started from. And then it all just snowballed into absolute chaos for a while I tried to understand the history of Impressionists and that sort of thing. And I came across this, I mean, the history of the Impressionists, it's so brilliant in terms of, like, they were just such anarchists in an artistic kind of sense. And it's, you know, when you look at the art world at that time, it was all controlled, the epicenter was Paris, and even sort of more specifically, the Paris Salon. Mm. And this group of men sort of lorded it over the art world and said what paintings were or were not. And the Impressionists came along and sort of, I don't know how to, I mean, outright rejected the notion that there were certain rules that had to be adhered to. And they came up with this new, very kind of emotive style that was characterized by, you know, kind of loose brush strokes that didn't blend the paint together. And technically, the Paris Salon or the people behind the Paris Salon would, and that school of art, they would look at it and go, you know, this is not how a painting should be. It breaks all the rules. Well, it actually is just a denial of the fact that the rules existed in the first place. Mm. So that's kind of the long answer to your question. It's been an interesting journey to sort of get myself into more creative, especially as someone who teaches photography, get myself in a more creative place and freed up from some of those rules.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, I mean, there's, you touched on a number of things there that that really sort of ring home. It's like you said about a 4-year-old could have done that. There's, it's really easy for people to say, looking at something that, oh, I could have done that, or a 4-year-old could have done that. But then there's, I think it was have you heard the Columbus egg or Columbus's egg story, where apparently this is credited to Columbus, but I'm not sure. I think there's a school of thought that thinks it or says it was someone else. But you know, he's found America. He's sitting there with a bunch of guys around a table having a beer or whatever they did in those days, and they said, yeah, well, anyone could have found America. It's like, you know, you've sailed in the right direction for long enough, you're going to bump into it. It's a big place. Mm. And he's sitting there and he says, okay, so how do you stand this egg up on its end? And they're all sitting around there with this egg, trying to make it stand up on the table, and nobody could do it. And in the end, Columbus, after everyone has struggled trying to balance it, really, you know, precariously balance this egg for a while, he cracked the end on the table and stood it up, because, of course, with a cracked end, it's got a base now. Mm. And they're all like saying, well, anyone could have done that. I said, yeah, well, who did? You know, who did that? And that's one of those stories that makes me think, you know, people always, they see something and say, oh, I could have done that. But they rarely do. And it's having the guts or the know-how or the... just the vision to do something that sets you apart from the people that could do it but never really did.
Yeah, I think absolutely. And I think it takes a certain amount of, I don't know if the right word is confidence, but certainly a thick enough skin to put something out there. And, you know, not that anything that I create is particularly, you know, paradigm shifting or anything, but it does, especially when it's work you are not known for, to put something else completely different out there. It does invite criticism, and so you have to be willing to say, well, I believe in this particular type of expression enough to, you know, take the odd hit on the chin.
Yeah, I mean, it's funny that you say that. I've got a bit of a theory that, and this comes from my own experiences. I mean, I used to be a lot more of a traditionalist than I am now, and I've got a theory that a lot of that comes from a lack of confidence. And I think that the people that, you know, some people are just traditionalists, they always will be, and that's fine, it's up to them. But I know for me, in my early days of photography, when I was saying, oh yeah, you shouldn't clone this in, you shouldn't change this, you shouldn't do that, it should be straight out of the camera, it all came, in hindsight, it all came from a lack of confidence. And I think that people that are that do lack a bit of confidence in their work. As you said, it takes a lot of guts to put this, to put stuff out there. It takes a lot of guts sometimes to even create it. And so I think that people that really want to stick to the rules, if they could just let go a little, and I think it's a bit of a leap of faith, but I mean, even you mentioned in your book that even if you want to continue to get it right in camera, to not actually publish this work, there's definitely an educational or a learning aspect to just trying, isn't there?
Well, there is, and it's a little like, if I don't play hockey, so this, I don't know why this metaphor comes to mind, but no one has ever accused me of having, you know, particularly astute metaphors, so I'll use it all the same. You know, the idea that when you as a hockey player, you go show up at practice, you do these drills. Well, you don't then go to the game and do drills.
Right.
You play hockey. The drills are not something that you do in order to get good at doing drills. Mm. You do them so that the muscle memory is there and so that you discover new things about your technique and you can work through particular weaknesses in, you know, I guess in the case of hockey, in your technique. Mm. And in the case of something like this, I think there's a great deal of value in not just practice, but in play, in making an intentional effort to go out and free yourself from the constraints that are in your mind. I have no problem with rules that you set on yourself. Yeah. If you, for example, I really like to get things as right as possible in camera. Mm. And I'm not one that spends a lot of time cloning things after the fact or cropping things. Yeah. But that's a constraint that I've placed on myself only because it feels right to me. Yeah. I would never say to someone else, you should or you shouldn't. But in terms of these rules, I think once in a while, it's really helpful that we just break out of what we're used to. You know, it's very easy to get into a rut, especially when, you know, we think we're in a groove. We wake up one morning going, oh, this rut is, this groove's not a groove anymore. I'm not flowing in this. I'm just stuck.
Yeah.
And being able to, I wrote a blog post the other day that kind of made a case for doing this stuff as creative exercise. And my three points really were, one, it helps us to see better. And that's the job of the photographer. It's not to make photographs with a camera. Mm. That's sort of the end result, but it never happens unless we are receptive and can see things. And so I argue strongly that breaking out of your conventional methods and your conventional process and going and getting on your hands and knees with a macro lens and seeing what the carpet looks like, or I like to stick a macro lens into a vase of flowers and just play with it, you know. Mm. I can do that for an hour and just contentedly exploring new worlds. But it helps me because when you get in close enough, the flowers aren't flowers anymore. They're line and shape and color, and they're the building blocks of every good photograph.
Yeah.
And so if you can make compelling photographs out of form and color when you're just playing around, that the freedom that you get from that discovery, the things that you learn, like maybe you spend an hour with this and you get something new out of it in terms of how you balance certain shapes against each other in the frame, or you never thought of this particular color combination, but there it is. If you come out of that playtime with that stuff, that will actually be lessons better learned than if you just kind of beat yourself over the head and tried to read a book about it. Hmm. You know, kids have been learning by play for millennia.
Yeah.
And you know, young animals, when they're born, I mean, that's how they learn their life skills, is through play. And I think the same thing is true. And this is so divergent from our usual activities to get in close, to move the camera. It's so counterintuitive compared to what we've learned that I think it's important, you know. It opens your eyes. It helps you kind of learn the skills. And I think those are significant when what we're after as photographers is to learn to see better and learn to use our tools better.
Yeah, yeah, absolutely. I remember it was great to see the photo that we took probably a few shoulders apart from each other in Hokkaido where we were doing the birch trees. It was great to see that in the book, but what I'd made a note before I even got to that point to talk about today, in that, on play, you I remember the group, every time we do this, I've been stopping at that location for a number of years now. And every time we do this, you can hear people laughing up and down the group. There's like a line of photographers at the side of the road. We all look like Japanese tourists bowing at the trees because we're all sort of moving the cameras up and down. But you can hear it. People in the group are laughing, and some people don't get it. It's like, so what are we doing here? You know, and then you explain, you show them the back of the camera, and it's like, oh, wow, look at that. And people all of a sudden are able to, because a lot of the time we're all trying to get, Sharpshooter, my ebook, it's sharp photographs of an eagle in flight or a crane or something. That's fine. But I mean, we also do we do a bit of panning. So we're doing the movement. And then this exercise with the trees, it just sort of sets the group free. And usually, I mean, with the tour that you joined last year, we actually did it in reverse because of hotels. So we started with that birch copse. But we normally, that's like on the second to last day. And the group have had, by that point, already 11 days of really hardcore photography. And they're getting tired. And it's almost like a release. We stand at the side of the road and the group is just having a lot of fun. And that's when a lot of the learning starts. And I think it opens people's minds to a certain amount of freedom. It frees them to play, which is, as you say, how humans have for a millennia, and animals and everyone learns just using our bodies to, like, you see lion cubs throwing each other around. They're learning how their bodies work, basically. And so, the idea of play as a way of learning new techniques and of nurturing new vision really is just really rings a bell with me.
Yeah, and I think it's really important. I think we are unfortunately in a culture in terms of the popular photography world where so-called perfection is really honored. And yet at the same time, I'm not sure that the perfectest of photographs it resonates with almost anyone. And in fact, the stuff that I look at over 100 years of photographic art, the images that resonate best with me, some of them are a little out of focus. The composition is not terribly precise. There are actually significant imperfections in that, collection of work over 100 years. Are they any less moving because of the imperfections, or are they in fact a little more moving? And I think they're more moving. I think it's one of the reasons people are so drawn to film is there's that imperfection. I have a friend who worked in one of the biggest animation studios in the world doing, you would know the movies if I told you. And he and I sat around one day talking about this idea of the too perfect theory, and they would actually pull back the technical perfection on a lot of their scenes because we just don't resonate with it. It's like looking at a really big HDTV that's just too sharp. It just doesn't feel real. And if it feels manufactured, we just don't connect with it. And so I think learning to embrace and even pursue the imperfections a little bit, that doesn't mean you can't be very meticulous with your composition. It doesn't mean that you can't also pursue excellence of craft. I think that's very important. But I think those things are a means to an end, just in the same way as going the other direction and being totally free and putting your camera on 1/8 of a second and moving the camera around to play with, the very basic building blocks of photographs. Because I've seen it. I've looked through. I mean, even in this book, there's case studies from several different photographers, all of whom are sort of pursuing these alternate means of expression. Mm-hmm. And I can get lost in their work. There's one guy, Tom McLaughlin, who's a Brit. I think he lives in or around London. And his stuff I can just look at it for hours, go through his website. It's beautiful. He uses a variety of techniques to abstract things and creates this. In fact, his website is called Ministract. Mm. And he just does these small little vignettes of his world, but done in abstract, and they're absolutely beautiful. I mean, he had one that's a steel pole, part of a steel pole against some kind of red background, and the way he's photographed it and then turned it, it looks like this sort of steel blue ocean with a flaming red sunset behind it.
Wow.
And yet it's not, and it's clearly not, but freed from this need to understand it, you can just look at it and go, oh my God, that's beautiful.
Yeah.
You know, and not even have to figure it out. It's not enough of a puzzle to go, so what is that really? You just don't care. All you're interested in is the experience. And if you can do that with your camera,
yeah,
I mean, that's a pretty cool thing. We're filled to the eyeballs of pictures of every conceivable thing on the planet. Now, I wonder if it's time to also create images that are just purely poetic and expressive without the need to say, this is the Taj Mahal in December, you know, during this kind of weather, to do something that moves people and makes them not even care that it's the Taj Mahal and just go, oh my God, that's beautiful.
I'd just like to jump in here and take a moment to thank once again our sponsors this week, lynda.com. Lynda.com offers over 2,400 high quality and engaging video courses taught by industry experts, with courses added weekly. Courses are for all experience levels, from beginner to advanced, and all courses are produced to the highest quality. It's not like watching a home video or something. If you want to improve your photography skills, learn about the latest photo gear, master the latest version of Lightroom, for example, Lynda helps anyone to learn software, creative and business skills, and to achieve personal and professional goals. Pricing starts at $25 a month and gives you unlimited access to thousands of courses. I've been using lynda.com since 2009 and have delved in for general photography information, as well as getting quick and easy access to instruction on things like new features in new releases of, say, Photoshop and Lightroom. I've studied copyright, Adobe Premiere Pro, After Effects, Flash, Fireworks, InDesign, among others. I mostly learn by doing, but many of the applications that we use today are so complicated that just opening and fumbling around with them can result in a lot of wasted time. So it's actually more efficient to set some time aside and go through the course before we start. That not only gets you up and running more quickly, but you also become aware of features that you probably would not have found by yourself. I often open the application while I'm going through the videos and go through parts of the exercises and, you know, just sort of compare my own screen to what the instructor's showing me. I use the exercise files to actually open up and play around with the same data. And, you know, once I've finished that, I then delve into the application. And at that point, I might not remember exactly how to do something, but I recall that it was possible to do something. And then I can go back to lynda.com, and because of the way the videos are structured, I can easily find the explanation that I was thinking of and just pinpoint the information that I need. The instructors are all professionals at the top of their field and passionate about teaching. You can watch from a computer, tablet, or mobile device, and whether you have 15 minutes or 15 hours free, you can learn at your own pace and in your own terms. With the monthly or yearly plan, you can download project files and practice along with the instructor. Courses are structured so that you can learn from start to finish or just jump in and find what you want, just a quick answer. In addition to the video, each course includes searchable transcripts, playlists, and certificates of course completion. And that's really cool. If you can publish these directly to LinkedIn if you want to, and that's great if you're a professional in that field. Premium members with an annual plan can also download the videos to your iPhone or iPad and watch them offline. I've worked out a great deal with lynda.com to provide you with a special offer to access the entire library free for 7 days. So visit lynda.com/MBP to start your 7-day free trial now. And that's lynda.com. Now let's jump back into our conversation with David Duchemin. I find myself sometimes looking through images and maybe it didn't go how I initially intended it to. But sometimes I'm looking at an image and I'll say, well, I know that I like it. I can't figure out why, I'm attracted to it. It just makes me feel good. And I think that we've got a tendency to want to understand why it makes you feel good. But if you literally, as you're saying, if you let go of that need to understand and just feel the photo, it really can become a wonderful way, a wonderful form of expression.
Very much. And you know what? I sorry to jump in. It just reminded me. I'm on this kick with a photographer named Saul Leiter right now. And he passed away in this last November. And I've always, you know, sort of liked his work, but I've never really sort of dove into it. You see a Saul Leiter picture in passing, and you know, it's very hard to mistake for anyone else. But he's got this one where he photographed it basically in New York for his whole life, just in these particular neighborhoods where he lived, and he has this way of composing with color, and there's this one shot that I wrestled with for so long, because it's like this it's photographed in the snow, and there's this line where the traffic is obviously turned right, and then in this photograph kind of up the frame, and there's this woman in like a red dress and a red umbrella, but he only puts half of the woman and half of the umbrella in the frame. And for the longest time, it nagged at me, but in a really beautiful way. I couldn't stop coming back and looking at it. And it wasn't because it was puzzle. It was just something in my brain said, I shouldn't like this. I should have a million reasons why this is a really weak photograph. But I kept coming back to it and going, I love this photograph. Like it just, there's mood and mystery and all the things that I like in a photograph. It just was done in such a way that I can't imagine ever composing a photograph like that. And yet now I see the possibility of it. And it just kind of underlined the point that this so-called technical perfection and rule of thirds and all this nonsense that we throw out there, if you can understand the principle, then you can, as you know, people like Picasso have said, you know, you learn the rules and then you break them. I would rather dismiss the rules altogether and learn principles, because I think it's a healthier way of learning. But either way, if you can kind of suspend that and just create something totally, you know, like totally obliquely lateral from what you normally do, that just goes in a completely different direction. I think a lot of photographers would be surprised by what they see in that sort of departure in their work.
And it certainly takes a certain amount of skill. I mean, not a certain amount, but often a lot of skill and understanding of what you're trying to do. I mean, the example I gave a moment ago, sometimes it's an accident and I'm like, okay, I don't know why I like it, but I do. But then, you know, other times you try to figure out what you did, or you take a certain technique and run with it, and then try to become good at recreating so what is sometimes a happy accident. And I think that the beautiful thing about the visual imagination, your latest book, is that it gives people a lot of really good starting points to you know, you, I love, for example, the, although I've been doing the vertical and horizontal pans, and you know, actually releasing the shutter while you're doing a vertical or horizontal pan, I've never really tried to make the circles or the ellipses that you've got a lot of wonderful examples in the book of. And I think that, you know, as an educational tool or as a way of learning, that it's a brilliant foundation, you know, you've given people the building blocks to go out and have a lot of fun with their cameras.
Yeah, and in fact, just purely from an educational perspective, I think of a lot of photographers started playing with these kind of concepts and techniques early on. They would have a much better grasp of the possibilities, especially inherent in sort of the exposure triangle stuff, the relationship between shutter and aperture and ISO. They would have a better understanding of film plane, you know, just or the focal plane, because when you start moving the camera around, one of the things you realize is I don't have to keep this on plane with my subject. I can actually make these motions kind of oblique and kind of egg-shaped or just something, so that you mess with some of these very preconceived ideas of, you know, what a photograph should look like. And I really think that if you gave, you know, a 16-year-old just starting out in photography, if you gave them some time to play with these and encourage that kind of thing, it might earlier break them of this need to, you know, slavishly follow rules and chase perfection, and instead just understand there's good craft and there are techniques that are, you know, need to be learned, but that it's not a technical craft, it's an expressive art, you know, accomplished by these technical means. Maybe it's splitting hairs, but I think if I had learned that sooner, I would have, I think, enjoyed enjoyed getting my way through those earlier stages of photography where I was wrestling with kind of this, I felt this need to kind of kick back at the need for perfection. And I was never kind of given permission to do that. And I wish I had.
Yeah, for sure. It's got to help people to understand the principles. But I mean, we keep saying that, the need for perfection and avoiding that. But I think that the images themselves, although they're not technically, they may not be sharp, I think they're still, many of them, perfect in that, they've reached the point where they needed to be absolutely beautiful. And I think that, the definition of the word perfect, meaning, technically perfect for sure, but the results of a lot of the images that you have in your book and sometimes you've got images from a number of other photographers in the book as well. They're all in many ways perfect. It's just that they're not perfect in the traditionalist sense. Mm.
Yeah, maybe that's an important distinction, is redefining what our goals and what, if perfection is one of those goals, certainly redefining it to say it perfection can include a lot of things. And one of the things that I think people get hung up on, especially with things like multiple exposures and intentional camera movement, is this kind of, well, how can you say that you're intentionally creating this when your process is completely chaotic? Mm. And it looks chaotic, but I think the more you do it, the more you understand certain motions create certain light trails, certain lengths of exposures create one look over another. And just like any other medium, you can control some of this chaos. And even then, it may take a few more images. Maybe it takes 60 images to get that photograph, or 20 or whatever. The skill that's needed from any other photographer when they go into the edit and choose the one frame that best expresses what they were trying to do, it's no different from the skill required of the abstract or the impressionist photographer who's doing something a little less traditional or literal and still sits down at the edit desk and goes, okay, I've used my craft and my skill to the best of my ability. Now, which of these frames gives me the best raw materials. Mm-hmm. So I think there's still an ability, in fact, a strong ability to, vision is still important. Composition is still important. It's not a call for people just to go out and throw their cameras in the air, although that may produce some interesting results. It's still a call to create something intentionally expressive. It's just that the process, I think all of the photographs we make rely on luck and serendipity and a certain amount of chaos. It's just that chaos in this particular instance is a little bit more out front. We grapple with that as sort of the entry. It's the first gate we enter through is this total chaotic process. Mm. But I know photographers who do this kind of work consistently and create, they have very much their own visual style. They are not just accidentally coming up with a bunch of photographs where the color works well. They make a couple photographs, they look at the way that the colors work together, the shapes that they've created, and then they change their approach, or they go a little sort of more specifically into one area of that approach, and they come out with some very intentionally created photographs. Mm. They just happen to be using a process that feels, at least initially, very unpredictable.
Mm. Yeah. There's, I think there's also one thing that I wanted to sort of tag on to all this as well. You might have touched on this earlier, but I do like to nail my focus. I like to get some images or most of my images absolutely traditionally perfect. And I think that, the one thing that I would like to add, as I say, is that I'm not the sort of person that's going to run out, and I know that you're not either, is going to run out and want to create only this sort of work. And I know that you're not trying to say to people, okay, throw away your current set of skills and just do this. But I think that it's definitely something that people can, I'm not going to say should, because it's obviously that's not what we want to be doing here, but people just keep it in the back of your mind while you're out and about. And it's like, you're walking through a park, you've got a beautiful scene in front of you with, I don't know, maybe some flowers and some trees like you've got in the book. And instead of thinking that you only are going to from now on shoot this sort of work, maybe just go out just for a certain amount of time, and either on a normal trip you're going to do your traditional photos and then you're going to play with this technique, or you may just decide that you're going to go out for a number of days where you only do this technique. But we're definitely, I mean, in your book as well, I'm sure that you're not saying this is the only way. You've got to throw away all of your traditional values as well.
Not at all. In fact, I think we get to a point where learning this stuff and playing with this stuff allows us to go back to the more literal tools of photography and use them with greater, in some cases, greater care, because you are still using the fundamental tools of photography. You're just using them a little differently. And when you come back, I think you can come back into that, whatever your specialty is. Maybe you do weddings or whatever, but I think they can be combined. I think there are possibilities out there, especially if you use strobes. Now, I don't use strobes, but with the ability to freeze motion, what if you were a wedding photographer and you used intentional camera motion plus a strobe burst at the very end of that exposure to capture something that was both literal and had this dreamy sort of motion? You know, maybe it's the bride dancing with the father or the groom and creating something just that's very different than usual. Sure, it would take some time to perfect, but you would have a tool that you maybe had never considered before. Mm. Same thing with me out in, there's an image in the book, I believe, when I was in Antarctica and we were sailing. And you've been there, so you know, at times you can get awfully bored of just being on the boat crossing the Drake Passage. And so I went out and just photographed with this particular technique because there was nothing else that I felt like photographing. And it gave me several hours of really great pleasure. And if we're going to be pragmatic about this, I mean, isn't this ultimately why we do photography? It's not always just to make the photograph. Sometimes the process itself of just being out there and messing around and seeing, I think it was Dorothy Lange said, it's the camera is a tool that teaches us to see what the world looks like when we don't have a camera.
Yeah.
And I think to play with this stuff and get that sense of play and wonder, even if you don't have a camera, I think you see lines differently, you see motion differently, because you're always thinking in your mind, what would happen if I moved the camera this way or that way? And as a result of even just that play, I mean, I came out with a couple of photographs that for me were the best photographs representing the feeling of the Drake Passage, which, as you know, can be somewhat turbulent and full of motion and a little bit surreal, especially if you're taking motion sickness drugs. So the the images that I came out from that particular play and experiment work better than the literal ones, and they can complement the literal ones. I would happily put them in a portfolio next to other photographs that are perfectly sharp and give the portfolio maybe a little bit more rhythm or depth to it.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, towards the end of your book, you quote Brooks Shaden, and part of the sentence I'm going to read out is, anyone that says she's cheating, this is you talking about Brooks Shaden. Anyone that says she's cheating doesn't understand the work of the poet. I wrote it down because it really rung a bell. It turned a light on, because although we've been comparing the techniques that you've written this book about to other visual arts, but I think that it's just ironic that we automatically give arts like poetry the freedom to write about anything they want, and we don't necessarily try to understand it. You mentioned it earlier. Poetry is already just by nature has got more freedom than a visual art, and I think that there's it's like a movie. We don't go and watch a movie where it's maybe a Hollywood movie where everyone's getting blown up all the time. We don't necessarily have to think that that's real. You don't say, did it really look like that when you're seeing something happen in a Hollywood movie? And I think that it's it just rung such a bell when you mentioned the poetry part, because we really don't need to understand poetry the way we do visual things. I don't know why that is. I mean, have you got any thoughts on that?
No, not particularly. I mean, I there's this great line in a song by a Canadian songwriter named Bruce Cockburn, and he says about the song's called Maybe the Poet, and one line is, "You and he may not agree, but you need him to show you new ways to see." Mm-hmm. And I think that's one of the gifts of photography, and to burden that gift with the need to be literal, to play by certain rules. I think we have always assumed that we talk about rules, and we talk about, you know, people cheating, you know, they use Photoshop and they're cheating. And well, they may feel that they're cheating because they're violating a particular artistic ethic or something. But for us to say that, I think it goes back to this notion that somewhere along the way we believed that the camera never lies. Mm. And that there is such a thing as objectivity in what we do. Well, no one ever said the paintbrush never lies. I mean, what kind of lunacy is that? Mm. You know, it's just an art, and they're saying what they want to say and the way that they want to say it. Mm. And I think the camera truly can create alternate worlds. And I mean, the case of Brooke Shaden, she does some amazing, beautiful, kind of somewhat dark and surreal kind of things at times, but her photographs have this sense of mystery. And yes, she does composites and that sort of thing. But to say that the photographer can't do that, when we all know that the cinematographers do it. Mm. We enter the movie theater, as you're pointing out, with this sort of willing suspension of disbelief. Mm. The same with a Cirque du Soleil show, you know, the same with a magic show. You enter. I had some astonishing moments in watching Cirque du Soleil, and you can even see the trapeze wires, for crying out loud. I mean, they're not trying to hide how they do it, and yet the sense of wonder that is there. No one stands up and goes, "I can see the wires." Well, no kidding, you can see the wires. You buy into the notion that you are suspending your disbelief for the time that you enjoy that experience. Mm. And I think as photographers, when we abandon the notion that the camera is objective and that it, you know, it never lies, and just allow the photographer to show you new ways to see, even if they're using Photoshop or whatever, I'm not sure there is such a line between photography and especially photography and traditions like Impressionism, Post-Impressionism. I just think we need to all lighten up just a little bit and enjoy things for the experience that they are, both literal photographs and things that are more expressive. So I'm not, as you pointed out, I'm not saying throw out one to embrace the other. I'm saying let's embrace as much as we can and allow it to inform our craft, even if you never put these more impressionistic or abstract photographs, even if you never do a multiple exposure for a client. There may be a time when knowing these skills and knowing the full breadth of the expressive potential of our cameras and lenses, that will play into your commercial work, your wedding work, your photojournalism. It will play into it because you better understand your tools, and you're a little bit more suspicious of the so-called rules and willing to explore possibilities. That's all it is.
Yeah.
The willingness to explore, what if I do this? What if I do that? And I find, at least for myself, even after 25 years, when I am thinking about my previous ideas of perfection and so-called rules, I ask the what if I do this, what if I do that questions with a lot more hesitancy and a lot less willingness just to barrel in and give it a try. I do much better when I just go to hell with it. You know, you could almost take the CF card out of the camera and just go play and see what happens. Yeah. Then you wouldn't feel any pressure because you know you're not making any photographs. So, you know, keep the CF card in the camera, but don't take it so seriously because you might come up with something brilliant. You know?
Yeah, yeah, absolutely. Well, you've enthused me to go out. I've been doing some of these techniques myself, but you've really, you know, the beauty in the images, especially, I was really touched by. I'm not sure if that's the right word, but some of the images where you've done the almost a full circle, and you've got, I'm thinking to myself, you know what, although I've been experimenting with the same technique, a long vertical, a straight line basically, and just the idea of doing these circles and maybe a swirl and all of this, it was more, a lot more new to me and a lot more fresh to me than the stuff I've been doing. So even though I'd been breaking the rules, I'd been breaking them in the same way. So you've enthused me to go out and give that a try as well. And
I'm pleased to hear that. I think, you know, that grove, I often think about, you give that example of that grove of birches in Hokkaido, and I will always think fondly of that, because it's the goofiest thing to watch, 12 people standing at the side of the road, bowing at these trees, and yet to see the joy in these sort of creative breakthroughs. And, as I recall, even though normally your tours, you do this sort of as a last thing, one of the benefits of this was that, for the rest of the trip, you could see people experimenting when there were moments. Let's face it, we can only concentrate on something for so long. You can only photograph, cranes or eagles or whatever for so long before you just need your brain to give it a rest for 10 minutes. Mm. And sometimes pointing the camera at some bright, shiny light or a specular highlight or a band of color and playing, after that 10 minutes is over and you go, okay, I'll probably erase all of those. But now you come back to photographing these more literal subjects with a renewed sense of play and not taking it so seriously. And in my experience, that's where the best work comes from, is when I've let it go a little bit.
Mm, absolutely. Well, David, I think what we should do is, obviously people can, it's on sale now, just out. So people can go over to craftandvision.com, and I'll have some links in the blog post for this as well. People, if you want to go to mbp.ac/417, you can see a few example images that I've pilfered from the Craft and Vision website.
Yeah, and make sure too that you go through Martin's website, because there will be discount codes on there. So for at least the next week from the time we launch this, you can get the book for 25% off if you have the discount code, and you can get that on Martin's site as well.
Thank you very much. So,
thanks, Martin.
Always a pleasure, David. And yeah. I look forward to our next chat. Was there anything you want to finish with?
No, I just really appreciate the time, and encourage those of you that are listening, don't think of this as I don't do that kind of thing. Part of the reason I wrote it is because I think all of us, no matter what that thing that we normally do is, we can all use a refresher on certain techniques, and I think more to the point, we can all use kind of these divergent creative ideas to go out and play with to open up our normal, more literal work to greater possibilities. So the book won't be for everyone, but for those it is, I hope you experience something new in your photographic journey because of it.
Yeah, and I'm sure everybody will. So that's brilliant. So really, thanks a lot for your time. You finish your glass of wine and enjoy your Sunday evening, David, and we'll catch up again soon.
My pleasure. Thanks very much, Martin.
Thank you. That was a lot of fun as usual. So as David said, there's a discount code that will be valid until April 21, 11:59 PM PST, and that will save you 25% off. So if you are listening to this before that point, then go over to the blog at mbp.ac/417 and pick up the discount code. And even if you're listening to it after there, I'll have, obviously, the links to everything are on the blog page, and there are some images that you can take a look at and check out before you go and buy. And note that I also have just finished working on the details of a new Namibia tour that's going to be in August 2015, again with my friend Jeremy Woodhouse. And if you are interested in joining us for the Namibia Full Circle Tour, it's a big tour and it's going to be incredible. Just go over to mbp.ac/Namibia2015 and you can find the details there. And it's also linked to the tours and workshops menu at the top of my website. So thank you very much for listening today. And you remember, you can find me on Google+, Twitter and Facebook, etc. And everything that I'm up to is all linked at the top page of martinbaileyphotography.com. So do drop by and take a look. I'll be back next week with another episode. But in the meantime, you take care and have a great week, whatever you're doing. Bye-bye.